107.
I have a short list. Here we go.
Whenever that's ready.
So we're missing next.
It's 107, it's May 13th. This is the police officer, locale police officer retirement, this is the board of trustees meeting. I am Matthew Stickman.
Doug Shively, board member.
Lee Diener, attorney.
Doug Lawson, actuary.
Larry Cole, consultant.
Dane Griffin, board member.
Dale Adams, plant administrator. Ray.
Ray Dunleavy, committee member, Mike Paul.
Okay. And also Alicia Gaither and Randy Griffin.
The first item on the agenda is review the minutes from the prior meeting. We have February 11th.
I move we accept the minutes.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Next item on the agenda is the retirement drop benefits for Jeff Bearstone and Brian McBride. Jeff Bearstone.
Okay, Jeff Bearstone elected to go into the drop on February 1st of this year after just over 25 years of service. He elected to take no lump sum and the retirement benefit was 100% continued to a joint annuitant in the amount of $55.41.74 per month.
I move we approve.
I'll second it. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Jeff Bearstone passes.
The second officer we have today is Brian McBride. He elected to go into the drop on the same date on February 1st. After 28 and a third years of credited service. And he also elected no lump sum with a monthly benefit of 100% continued to a joint annuitant in the amount of $54.92.62.
I move we approve.
I'll second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
Okay, thank you, Ray.
Welcome.
Next is Foster and Foster.
All right. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good to see you all again.
You better.
Good to see you.
I see you all have our green reports, but I'm going to present with the one-page handout as a summary. Everybody have one? If you want to follow along here, I think everybody else got one. Okay? We have some extras here on the table.
Ray, this is something we just received. I didn't have that to email it to you, but.
Okay, I figured that out already.
Yeah, sorry. I just made this up in the last couple of days. Something new I've implemented this year. So I think something easier to follow along because we never go through every section of the report. So I pulled out the main points in the report and found the summary sheet. Okay? And I've shown two columns, the 2011 valuation and the 2012. So we'll go through those main points and then entertain questions or comments. And you can feel free to interrupt along the way and I'll answer whatever I can. Do you have any questions or observations on the report before I get into the details of the summary sheet? Okay, let's just go ahead and go right down the line here, and then we'll answer questions along the way. The return of the market value of assets with the last valuation, when, if I say last year, I mean the 2011 valuation, just to make it clear, was minus 0.6%. So the last valuation we did, remember, you basically got a goose egg on your investment return. The contributions still made assets grow, but the monies that were invested actually lost a little bit of money. Well, that story was much different this last year. By our calculation, you netted out 18.4%. That's after all the investment fees. It's actually a really solid return, higher than we've seen on average. Most plans got a really good return this last year, 15 to 16% range. So 18.4 is beat the average in Florida, at least for my plans. What's nice is that will be phased in over a five-year period. So that's actually going to generate some favorable experience over the next 4 years. The return on that actuarial value of assets, that's your five-year smooth, that's still low for one final year. In 2011, it was 0.5%. That was your five-year average was 0.5. Your five-year average as of 2012 is 1.4. What that tells me is normally that should have actually gone down another year. But the fact that the 18.4 came in and replaced, you know, the return that fell off from 07 was a pretty good return. It just happened that 18.4 was better. So your five-year average went up. Had you just got your 8% this last year, your five-year average actually would have gone down a little bit. So that was helpful. Another thing that's helpful is that last year the assumption was 8.25. Now it's only 8. So you have a lower target to hit. So it's going to be easier to get to your assumption, and you're less likely to generate actuarial losses going forward on the investment side. Money in the bank. Market value of assets last year, $39.1 million. Now, $46.7 million. So, and that's net. So that's a $7.5 million net increase, money in the bank, in the 12-month period. And that's a combination of net contributions after benefit payments and also the 18% return. So a real healthy increase. I have a hunch you're closing in on the $50 million mark very, very soon. In fact, if you haven't already hit it. And I would guess that's a new high water mark for your plan. Actuarial value of assets, your five-year smooth. Last year, $45.6 million. Increase to 46.6. So a slower increase, but that's because it's a five-year average, but still an increase. Your two funded ratios, the short-term funded ratio, that's the FASB 35. That's a comparison of money in the bank to current benefits using just paying service to right now, no projection. Nice increase. A year ago was 68.6%. So think 68.6 cents on the dollar in the bank to cover current benefits. That grew to 74.9%. So a real nice increase in 1 year's time. And that one increase, that particular funded ratio goes up fast when you have a nice return on market assets. The GASB funded ratio, that's the long term, that stayed essentially the same, from 65.9 to 65.8%. And that's because that's tied into projected benefits and your five-year asset smooth. Once that five-year average begins increasing, your GASB 25 funded ratio should start taking off also. Average increase in pension to pay, that's the salary increases to the individual police officers. The last 2 years, it's been right around 3.5%. The assumption a year ago was 6%. With the experience study that was implemented a year ago, the assumption for pay increases is now down to 5.4. So you're currently generating actuarial gains on salary assumption. when you assume salaries will go up 5.4, but they only go up 3.5, you get a gain back. The net actuarial gain loss, this is whether we add or subtract from debt. We added to debt $1.4 million in 2011, and this last year we had an additional amount of $1.7 million. Again, that's because your five-year average, even though it's higher than the year before, you're still short. You're still not at the 8% assumption. And so we had to add to debt another $1.7 million. But again, going forward, it's going to be a lot easier to start getting credits towards debt. And in fact, I think we'll start generating some gains in the next couple of years, is my hunch, where we can start getting some of this past investment loss paid off. Estimated city contribution requirement in the current year is 32.5%, and projected for fiscal 13-14, it would be 37.5%. The remaining credit balance the city has access to, prior excess monies that are available to help fund, is $326,000, so that's still available to the city. I believe they used some of it this last year. And finally, if you look at the bottom, here's some nice news. This is a projection of your five-year asset smooth average going forward. If you just get your 8%, that's what these numbers show, that in 2013, your five-year average will be 6.3%. Now, not yet at the 8, but a whole lot closer than it's been in years. In 2014, your five-year average will be 8.1. In 2015, your five-year average would be 8.2. So both of those years, you'll be slightly beating your 8% assumption. One number I forgot to put on here is, see where it says 2016 and later? Just, you can cross out the and later. The 2016 five-year average should be 10%. If you just get eights going forward, your five-year average in 2016 should be 10%. The reason for that is you'll have one final year of the 18.4 from this year and 4/8 to follow. If you average that all in, it's 10%. And then 2017 and later, we assume you'll have 8% returns. That's the assumption. So I'll be happy to answer any questions. If you have any items that you'd like to go into in greater detail, we'll just get to the reports and I'll show you the page.
Let me ask for an explanation of a couple of numbers.
Okay.
Let's take FASB 35. So that's approximately 75 cents on the dollar to fund the benefits that are now being paid. Is that
what? Benefits being paid and for the retirees, and current accrued benefits frozen to date for the active police officers.
Okay.
They were to freeze their benefit.
Ah, okay.
So it's kind of both numbers are theoretical in a sense, because not every benefit is currently being paid out.
Right.
It just gives you a sense of time of how well the assets have kept up with benefits.
So we have to grow the assets. Ideally, we have to grow the assets another 25 cents to be a...
to cover promised benefits.
Okay.
These plans are, unless the actuary is explicitly assuming something different than the long-term assumption, it's just ignoring reality. The assumptions in your plan are based on what's happened up to this point. Unless we're using a set of assumptions that we just know are different than what the future holds or will hold, the plan is funded so that the benefits can be paid. The assets will be there to pay when benefits are due. Mm-hmm. That's why our firm has been pretty adamant that you should not focus on funded ratios as the end all, because not 100% of the benefits are not payable at any given time.
Right.
We just need the monies to be there as they come due. Mm-hmm. And the plan is funded in such a way to make sure that happens.
And then Let's go down to net actuarial gain or loss, where we have a $1.7 million deficit. Is that just sort of stating the same thing in terms of that we have, we're short 1.7 as far as paying benefits?
It just means that in your net experience this last year, the normal cost, the piece for accruing benefits, wasn't sufficient to cover everything that happened up to this point in time.
Okay.
And most of it has to do with the asset loss as well. But the benefits are promised. So we need some catch-up payments to come into the trust fund. So it's basically a separate amortization. It's a separate debt payment for the city that's included in the total. So if you see that 37.5% contribution, the additional amount for that $1.7 million debt, the annual payment for that debt is included in the 37%. Basically, we need catch-up contributions to make sure benefits can be paid when they come due.
Okay, now I understand.
Any questions?
We kept hearing a lot last year with that Collins Institute report and all that about unfunded liabilities. Is that what you're referring to when you're talking about the funding ratio?
Yeah, that's why I put it on here, is because everybody wants to know what's the funded ratio now. And I figure it's helpful to show you before and after so you can see the change from one year to the next. Now, going forward, if you just get your 8%, what will happen is the FASB 35 will still grow, but it'll get back to a normal pace of 2 to 3 percentage points a year. But your GASB will start catching up with that also. Your GASB funded the long term should start growing like the FASB in the next couple of years.
And just to make sure that I understand, because this is, that seems to be about the only, besides cost, about the only thing that the city cares about is the funded ratio. And eventually we'll have to discuss that. The reason ours went down this year, even though we had an enormous year, was because of the other years tied to the 5-year smooth.
You're still holding on to a piece of the 08.
Right.
That's going to fall off. Going forward, the net total in the next 5 years should be an investment gain in totality, just because of that 18%+ from this last year. So we should actually begin writing down some debt over the next 5 years.
Well, Doug, the difference between FASB and GASB. FASB is based on benefits earned to date,
correct?
GASB is projected benefits to be earned every time.
Relatively higher, a brand new officer right now, we have X amount of debt that's due to him in 25 years, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's using a projected benefit, and also we're using two different asset values. The FASB uses market, which is fair market, and right now GASB uses deferred, so it's using a 5-year smooth. And really, the GASB is just trailing. It's behind the FASB. The GASB is what goes in the city's camper, by the way. FASB never makes it there.
The report's acceptable. It'll need to be approved by motion.
I move we accept the actuary's report.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Now, having done that, you'll need a motion to determine total expected annual rate of return for the current year, the next several, and long term based on Larry's recommendation. You may recall we had to do this by statute since 2000.
That would be 8%.
Good afternoon.
All right. Okay.
What do we call this? The 8%.
Yeah, we need a motion.
Anticipated rate of return.
Total expected.
Near term?
Yes.
What's the wording on that, near term, intermediate, long?
Current year, next several years, and long term there.
8%.
Yes.
I'll make a motion on that.
Are you the president? I've moved that we continue our expected rate of return at 8%.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Motion passed.
Perimeters out there, if you need to get them.
Larry, do you? Yeah, we'll let them hear, do they do it? Does Alicia do it? I don't involve.
Have you got that letter on file, you need us to send you?
Can you do that letter down?
We've got one, I think Alicia did it last year. Sometimes they've been asking for backup information, which we've provided in the past. Why don't we do that? We'll go ahead and send you that letter with the backup before they kind of be proactive, because they've been all over the place on these letters, I mean, on the assumption rates.
Okay.
At 8%, they don't say anything, you get a 7.5, and they're saying it's too high, so.
Hey Dale, can you turn your volume up a little bit?
Can we turn up the? I know we can turn up the volume on the speaker.
Control, yeah, that's better.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. They're stepping out to bring perimeter into the meeting now. Right.
Okay.
I might catch you up that sheet there, which is a summary that Doug used for, to summarize the overall evaluation report.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
How are y'all doing?
Good.
Our finger lab.
Nice to see you.
How you doing?
I'm a smoothie. How are you all today?
Good, how are you?
Good.
We brought some handouts, some books, and maybe some of those stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Send some down that way. We got 10 total, or I think 9, all of you, so.
Thank you.
Sorry, can I make sure there?
And you want like, this is electronic, I don't know if you keep electronic copies.
Yeah, but not if you.
I'm gonna go do that. These are file those e-copies. Well, Larry asked us to present, you know, about 15 minutes or so, but we want to make sure we get all your questions answered, so let's make this as interactive as possible, want to make sure we get all the questions addressed. I thought what we would do to start is, just by way of maybe a more formal introduction, and Terry Benson, who was here a couple of years ago, meeting with you all initially. Today I brought Mark Gerfinkel with me as well, and Mark is the portfolio manager. So Mark is, besides being the one that is choosing the stocks in the portfolio on a day-to-day basis, Mark's also the co-architect of the strategy, which began back in 1998. So today you'll hear a lot of comments where Mark will talk a lot about the history of the strategy, which does go back about 15 years now. To get started, I'll maybe just provide a brief update on the firm. You know, you may recall we are Atlanta-based. We were founded in 2006 after having run this small cap growth strategy for SunTrust's subsidiary, investment subsidiary, which was then branded as Wellsville Capital. We founded the firm to be an institutional money manager, focusing predominantly on small cap equities, and certainly we've done that since our launch in 06. As a reminder, the type of portfolio that we run is small cap growth. We believe that small cap growth is among the most volatile of the asset classes in terms of the stocks and how they will move and behave. You can lose 40 to 50% of a stock's value in a given trading session. So in order to mitigate that risk to clients' portfolios, we believe in diversifying across a high number of names, going from 150 to as high as 200 over the 15-year history. And we believe that by diversifying across that many stocks, we are able to mitigate an individual stock from hurting the overall portfolio and kind of having us, you know, kind of down and out for a long period of time. So that's, again, just a real quick, oh, and then, so the result of that, like, if I conclude there, the result of running a highly diversified portfolio is that we, you know, have been able to keep up generally with an uptrending market, more of a normal market cycle. But where we really tend to earn our stripes is when the market inevitably has its downturns. And when it has its downturns, this highly diversified portfolio tends to generally preserve capital, doesn't go down as much as the market. And so if you don't lose as much, you know, time in, time out, you're able to actually outperform as long as you're able to keep up in those up markets.
So, yeah, so we've been speaking from page three as kind of reviewing our approach to the asset class. And I think if there's one thing that you take away with you from this meeting, is that's the what we have always been about, developing and generating more consistent returns through that type of diversified approach and selecting quality small cap growth stocks. A strong emphasis on quality in our stock selection. And certainly that has always been the hallmark of what we do. It was what made us very successful over our first 11 years when we first presented to you guys. And it's one of the reasons as to why, and this approach is the key reason as to why we've been able to outperform the benchmark in down quarters 3 out of 4 times. So 75% of the time, we've been able to beat the Russell 2000 growth when it posted a negative quarter. Now, more recently, we've been a little bit challenged in that regard. And so I think that is, we'd like to spend the rest of our time kind of addressing not how our long history, okay, but also the recent history, the experience that y'all have had. There have been, you know, two of those quarters that fall into that 25% bucket in recent history over the last couple of years, where we didn't necessarily accomplish what we've been able to accomplish historically in those down quarters. And so I'd like to address in a moment those quarters specifically and what transpired. If you turn to the page six, I think it does a nice job of drawing the different time periods of our track record that include the time prior to the Great Recession, what the performance of our portfolio during the Great Recession, what's happened since and what's happened since that time. So heading into the strategy's first 9 to 10 years of performance, 9 years or so, had significant outperformance versus the benchmark in what we would consider very normalized markets that started kind of with the bursting of the tech bubble and you know, producing 11% annualized return versus the benchmark of roughly 5%. During this time period, there was a strong emphasis in the market on quality stock selection. And we actually have a chart to demonstrate that period. Page 12 highlights kind of what was behind our strong performance during that period. This chart, what it demonstrates is the performance of the top companies based on profitability metric called return on invested capital. So it takes the top versus the bottom. The top represent high quality, those that generate strong returns. The bottom represents low quality, the lowest return types of companies. And this plots the relative performance of high quality versus low quality. When the line's moving up, high quality outperforming. So during this period, three significant periods of significant outperformance versus quality. And this has been a strong tailwind for our outperformance through 2009. Since that time, you can see that while there have been some fits and starts with quality, there hasn't been any type of sustained quality trade. So then we back, kind of turning back to page six, you can see in the financial crisis, we protected a little bit of capital, outperforming the benchmark during that period of time by 4%. Always like to do better during those tough times, but when the financial crisis hit and the bear market and the waterfall decline ensued, pretty much took all stocks down equally. Then we have the recovery from the post-financial crisis. We have to remember what happened in that Great Recession. Memories can be very short. Investment firms, strong, large names investment firms, Bear Stearns, Lehman, went out of business. And there was a lot of upheaval and financial turmoil. And you had a lot of aftershocks along the way. The economy's kind of been slow to get its footing back underneath it. It created a certain type of environment where investors were really jittery, if you will, okay, where it was more of a market where it was very much what we like to call risk on versus risk off, and where investors were not focused so much on the fundamentals of companies, they were more focused on the macro headlines that we're seeing on the news and trading stocks based on those macro headlines. Now, during this period, the market was up 27% in this post-financial crisis recovery through March of 13. Those are what we would call, and I think Larry might call, abnormal returns that you're not necessarily going to experience heretofore, where normalized returns might be more in the 10 to 12% range for equities long term. Now, historically, we have done a pretty good job of capturing that performance of the benchmark to the upside. During this most recent period, not quite as good, okay, because of a couple of things. Number one, the strong up move. Also, stocks being highly correlated, moving in the same direction in that risk-on, risk-off fashion. And then thirdly, the lack of a sustained quality tailwind to stock selection, where investors aren't necessarily paying up for quality as they typically have. So we still produce some pretty solid absolute return numbers during that period. And as I said, during this period, what's been a little abnormal is that there have really only been three down quarters in the last 15 quarters that make up this big, strong up move that we know is not going to persist for forever. And it was those two quarters where we're most disappointed that we didn't produce the results that we're accustomed to producing. The two quarters are the third quarter of 2011 and the second quarter of 2012. In the third quarter of 2011, you may recall that the market from the fiscal budget debate discussions and kind of a rehash of fears over the European sovereign debt issue caused a tremendous waterfall, a tremendous decline and instantaneous decline of stocks from the end of July through the end of that third quarter in September 30th, 2011. Now, the benchmark ended that quarter down about 21 or 22%. We modestly underperformed the benchmark by about 50 basis points. Typically, that is a quarter we would expect to outperform. But what happened was you had this tremendous flight to safety. Now, when we build our portfolio of quality companies, we're not building it for safety. Okay, we try to build it to capture growth, but protect to the downside. And what happened during this period was the market treated all companies with economic sensitivity the same way. It punished those companies. And companies that, like utilities, consumer staple food companies, REITs, these companies were the ones that really held up during this time. And that leads us to the last quarter, the second quarter of 2012. Last year, where we underperformed the benchmark by over 3% during that period. This was an anomaly type of quarter for us. Our stock selection was impacted by performance in consumer discretionary and technology. We had very good stock selection prior to that time in consumer discretionary. And during that time period, we stayed with consumer discretionary a little too long. We had very good performance in the first quarter. And what happened was you had weather impact sales such that it pulled sales in. Very good weather in that winter, much the opposite of this year. And then and pulled forward the sales. And then many of these companies had to pre-announce shortfalls of earnings. And we experienced a negative impact in those companies. Now I'd like to see if there are any questions to address those, the recent underperformance trends, and then be happy to talk about what we've been seeing more recently that really gives us, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel, if you will, the last 9 months or so, where we've seen a change in trend, if you will, in the character of the market.
What's the catalyst that you see out there that's going to make fundamentals matter again? Because they just don't seem to have mattered the last two years plus. Just throw your money in the stock market and let it go, and all the homework on the company doesn't seem to be paying off.
Yeah, well,
we got it right.
We really started to see that turn in the middle of last year, July, August time frame. And if you think about it, what's an example of how that's occurred? Why I think that's occurred? I mean, you really started to see more of different types of sectors and companies performing well. You look at it at the individual company level during periods where you might not have expected that to happen. Secondly, another way of looking at it is we have a lot of headline news. We were not without a lot of headline news in the last 6 to 9 months. And notice how all that headline news created the fears and jitters that caused the stock market these dramatic sell-offs in the prior 2 years. But then last year, in the latter part of last year and into the first quarter of this year, even with the looming fiscal cliff that is still not fixed, if you will, the market hardly reacted. So the market's up 51% in a year and a half since the bottom in 2011. It's up 21% since November, without as much as a 5% correction. So, what's that showing? I mean, the market not reacting, it means investors are less jittery. There's less angst, and it's because of stronger underpinnings in our domestic economy, looking at indicators like unemployment trends, which now seem to be gradually but consistently getting a little bit better.
Also the Fed, I mean, you know, we've also seen just this kind of risk-off trade, the historic amount of easing that the federal, you know, government treasury has gotten into, and so that can't persist forever. But to Mark's point, their correlations have definitely come down since the end of second quarter last year, so that's showing really investors have some bit of discernment between companies that are putting up good returns or putting up good earnings quarter in, quarter out. It's not quite where we've, you know, seen it over the course of certainly Mark's career and the time that we've been running the strategy. It feels like things have definitely come down, and we've even included a chart that shows the correlations subsiding a little bit, meaning the macro is not quite as strong a driver.
And that chart's on page 13.
Sorry, say that page number again.
Page 13.
Okay.
So it shows the correlations dropping. That means there's less of the macro backdrop, the less risk on, risk off being felt in the marketplace. We believe that the fall, that the third quarter of 2011 was the crescendo or the bubble, if you will, in that fear trade, in that risk on, risk off trade. But we've really started to see things get a little bit better in the last 9 months. During that period through the first quarter, we outperformed the benchmark by 1% over that 9-month period. And that is without actually yet having seen quality, turn to the page 12, seeing quality really turn up yet. So we're looking for that quality to kind of couple with the environment that we're now the environment that we're now experiencing to really get back on that path, putting up those 3% excess return years that we've been accustomed to in the past.
Just so everybody understands, on page 13, when he's talking about correlation, what we've had the last couple of years really is a market that's just everything's going up. So there really isn't too much distinction between the companies. I think there's been none. And if anything, it's been negative. In other words, companies with good earnings, good balance sheets, good solid earnings growth haven't been rewarded anymore. In fact, have been rewarded a little bit less in many cases than companies with poor balance sheets and low quality earnings or no earnings. So the market, a lot of money just flowing into ETFs. And when I asked the question what he thought the catalyst would be
for it to, for the homework to matter again, you know, that you're doing your homework, picking good stocks, picking good companies, but you're not getting rewarded for it. We've seen it with other active managers. So when will that cycle, what will be the catalyst to make that matter again? I think probably the Fed is the key answer to that. And when the Fed turns off the spigot and there's no longer just money being pumped into the economy, then people will do, you know, companies that have good quality earnings will make it again. So they're kind of an unusual cycle in that regard. He has shown a chart on 13. When correlations become lower, stock picking usually gets, you know, good fundamentals get rewarded. So that's kind of where we are in the market, and explains a little bit of their underperformance. We've seen it in some other managers, particularly managers who focus on good, high-quality balance sheets and companies. So I'm not too alarmed at the start here. They actually had a pretty decent year, a good quarter. Sounds like they're having a good quarter to date. So I think they're starting to climb out of that hole a little bit. They dug from for the first couple of years.
Happy to address any other questions, but we're sensitive to the fact that we've gone over just a little bit.
I have a question. This is really down my way. I'm not actually present at the meeting. How has your small cap growth performed in relation to other small cap growth? We take a look at that segment of managers the last, say, 3 to 5 years.
Yes, sir. Because the last 3 years, I mean, it has not performed as we have historically performed over time. The last 3 years, I mean, we're running probably somewhere in the 75th to 80th percentile during those time periods relative to other small cap growth managers. So this type of environment, I think what you might characterize it as, when we have a 15-year body of work, and 11 years, we see, for 11 years, we see really kind of bulletproof. I think you might say the recent environment that we experienced proved to be our Achilles heel, much like all managers have their own Achilles heel. But we feel like we're moving out of that environment that's been the headwind for us.
I think it's attributable to having to stock selection and having perhaps 200 issues in the portfolio?
Yeah, that's a great point. Thank you for bringing that up, because one of the things that we have done during this time period is we've actually brought the number of names down to the lower end of our range, holding approximately 150 companies in the portfolio. This high correlation environment, as a follow-on to Larry's comment, is also more difficult for diversified managers to differentiate themselves in that type of environment. If all stocks are moving in the same direction, the more stocks you hold in the portfolio, the more difficult it is to produce that alpha and differentiate yourself and, say, run and hide, be able to run and hide in a couple of larger positions. We've always relied on smaller position sizes and use broad-based stock selection to generate our alpha, and that is what has been the key to our ability to deliver consistent performance results, meaning outperformance with low tracking error in through 2009.
Ray, this is Larry. I've got the actual numbers. It's 86th percentile for 3, 72nd for 2, and 57th percentile for 1. So the trend seems to be improving a little bit. They outperformed for the quarter relative to their benchmark. So dug a hole when they got started with y'all, but it looks like they're climbing out of it a little bit. And I think that probably does, as Mark just pointed out, probably relates pretty closely to this chart that you don't have in front of you.
No, I don't.
The correlation chart showing that back just a few quarters ago, the correlation of stocks in the market, you know, this is in the S&P, were about 86%, and now it's down to about in the 50s, 50 to 60%. So it seems to be, as that correlation number comes down, their performance has improved rather substantially. So
is their market cap about the same? Are they consistent in that?
Yes, our market cap is running about 1.7 to 1.8 billion currently. maybe at since quarter end, a little bit lower than that, and that's right in line with the benchmark, slightly less.
Okay.
Just a comment to add off to Larry's numbers that he provided. He said that the trend is improving, and although 9 months is a bit of an odd time frame, you heard Mark earlier say that we really started to see correlations come down middle of last year. So if you were to look at third quarter, fourth quarter 2012, and first quarter of this year, our peer rank is about top third. I think we're 34th percentile. So again, it's one of those things where companies are. Yeah. So.
If we broke it down, I just jumped by the way we do our reports, but when we did our work on them and broke it down, we could see that trend starting to go quarter by quarter getting better. So probably a time to stay patient.
Any other questions for you?
Can you talk about the down market performance? Just, is it a long enough trend on that?
We haven't had any. Yeah, that's the problem. We really only had three quarters out of 15, so you don't really have. One of the reasons they got hired originally was, you know, over their 15-year period, the down market protection was pretty good. I don't remember the exact number, but I know it's something we looked at. And it's usually something I focus on when I recommend managers to you. So we get in these real, real strong bull markets. Most of the managers, quite honestly, that you have, I expect will struggle. They'll be running hard to keep up in these kind of bull markets, but they more than make it up for you longer term. As you, most of you have been on board long enough now to see that trend, when it goes the other way, they tend to make it up for you when we get any kind of sustained but fair market. So still, I don't see any reason to believe they haven't changed what they do when you hired them, or they haven't changed how they do what they do from when you hired them. And we've just been in a very strong bull market, and I think the absolute numbers are good. The relative numbers are lagging for 3 years, but as I said, improving every period we're looking at shorter than that. So it looks like they're maybe on the right track here. You got anything else, Ray?
No, I have nothing else.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having us
out. Appreciate
that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. I didn't sit on that side of the table. It wasn't wearing the right color.
I know. The orange thing.
They officially took on it. That's the official name. Pumpkin. Pumpkin.
Next week it'll be all gone and gone.
Next will be the fixed asset performance and investment. Excuse me.
And do the guideline stuff first.
Either way.
Yeah. If you'd rather do your week, do this real quick. No, this is good. We'll make this quick.
That's just how I listed them on the report.
Yeah.
And
let's take a look at. I've got enough there to go around. I got to do it. Here today. Lee, I don't think I ran this by your office first this time. Usually I do, but I don't remember if I did or not. Not a major change. At the last meeting we talked about how to protect bond assets in a rising interest rate environment. I don't know if you'll remember that. David Furfine was in. He actually brought some very good information about how he would expect the portfolio to perform if rates go up 1%, 2%, 3%, or whatever. So the whole point of that was you've got still, about 30, I forget the exact number, but let's say 30% of the portfolio in bonds. And that particular asset class, 29.2, that particular asset class, so we've lowered the exposure to the asset class. You've invested in convertibles, and you got the small cap managers, Frontier and Perimeter. But we tried to lower the exposure to the asset class, so that's step one. You think bonds are risky, and bonds are risky, again, because in a rising interest rate environment, the market value of the bonds goes down. So if you got a 5% coupon, if your duration, which is kind of the average maturity of your portfolio, is 5 years, rates go up 1%, you lose 5% of principal, you got 5% in income, your return is zero. Well, you can easily get into negative return territory in bonds also, right? Where rates go higher and your market value drops more than the income you're receiving. We think we're in an environment, we're looking out over the next 3 to 5 years, let's say, do you think rates are going to be higher than they are today, 3 years down the road? The answer is, most people would say, probably so. Because we're at such historical lows right now. So the next step, number one, we've lowered the exposure to bonds. Number two, we talked about the fact that the bogey, the benchmark for Sawgrass in this case was the Barclays Aggregate Index, which has a duration, which is interest rate sensitivity again, has a duration of about five and a half almost. So internally, their policy, as most bond managers, so I wasn't picking on Sawgrass, but internally their policy would not allow them to go more than about 20% shorter than that benchmark. That's one way you protect assets in a rising rate environment, is to shorten your duration, shorten the sensitivity to interest rate movements. And so even with that, they're not going to go very low. So David and when we were talking, we discussed the options, and one of them was to give them a little more flexibility in their benchmark, in the bogey. In other words, I want him, he's the expert, that's what you pay them to do. They're fishing in that bond market every day. If he thinks the market is very risky and wants to shorten that duration more to protect your assets, I want him to be able to do it and not to come back and say, well, the benchmark's this, and I was managing to the benchmark. So what we did, if you go to the handout I just gave you in the red, go to page 4 first. Randy, you need a copy?
That's all right.
We got a copy, just want to kind of see what's going on. On page 4, you know, the previous benchmark was just the Barclays Ag. What we did, and I talked with David, David's read this and agrees with it, so if you all approve it, it's already passed his smell test from the standpoint of whether he's comfortable with this. This gives them a new bogey, and that bogey is going to be a combination of the Barclays aggregate and the Barclays 1 to 5 years. This could allow him to lower that duration by at least a couple of years, maybe a little bit more. The weightings for each will vary over time, be confirmed in the addendum to the investment policy statement. In other words, he's going to recommend to us, hey, I'm going to take 25% of this money and shorten it. I'm going to manage it to that 1 to 5. He may come and say, I'm going to take 30%. He may come and say, I want to take 40%. But I want him being the one recommending that, because he's the bond manager. And so in this case, when he does, we'll change his addendum, which is his benchmark, and you know, measure his performance accordingly. But this gives him that flexibility to do that, and that's all this language is. So.
But if he comes to us and changes with us on meeting only 4 times, I mean, how much is this going to cause lag time back and forth, or is this going to be he can do it?
He can do it. This gives him the leeway to do it. All we'll do then after the fact is come in. I may come in. It could be under this arrangement. It's going to be a little bit different. I might come in. If he does it 3 times in a row, mm-hmm. or 3 quarters in a row, I'll come in every quarter and say his new benchmark is this, and we change the short-term bond thing from 20 to 25, or we change it from 25 to 30. But he's already there, and he's got the flexibility to do that here. So it doesn't have anything, you know, this gives him that flexibility within his own firm, from their internal policies, and by the board to shorten that duration. We'll adjust whatever we're measuring him against as we need. There's nothing urgent about that. We'll just adjust it to kind of better reflect what he's doing. Because I don't want him in a position where he's being measured against a long-term bond index when he's managing short-term bonds. Now, he will ultimately get called on when he makes, or get measured on how he makes that call. And we'll be monitoring that too, because it'll show up in how his overall bond numbers perform relative to bond managers, bond universe, not the benchmark.
So I guess that was going to be my next question then. What do you see as a potential downside, him pulling the trigger too fast on what he's changing and taking away potential earnings?
Let me tell you what, there's no perfect answer to this, but let me tell you, the downside risk for him with this benchmark is he gets too conservative too soon right, and protects your assets too soon. The downside by not making this change is rates take off and you lose money. The downside, as I see this, is you might not make quite as much money, but you don't lose as much money. And that's why, like the bond portfolio, we don't want a lot of risk with bonds, right? That's kind of there to stabilize. And this gives them that flexibility. Does that make sense?
I understand what you're saying. Yeah. What I guess is confounding me, and not being an expert in any means, but we talked about interest rates. We've been talking about this for probably the last 3 weeks, so almost a year.
Right.
Nobody is talking about it. That's what I don't understand. I mean, you don't see it in the news. You don't see it. Maybe
a little bit. There are a lot of people. Not every meeting I go to now, bonds are discussed. Yeah. Of course, I'm there with them. But even other meetings, people are talking about the risk, and they're the fire. I don't do the fire, and I'm sure it's been brought up. So they are talking about it. And if you're watching the CNBCs, you know, during the day or whatever, it's like, you know, I have it on all day, every day. So in my office when I'm in there. Isn't that often anymore, but anyway, when I am there, and there are people saying, you know, this is a risky asset category.
Yeah, no, I understand that, but you know, you almost hear when there's inflation, I guess, like when inflation is actually going on, it's in the mainstream news, the newspaper, everywhere you look, people are talking about it, but it's like now
it's not there yet.
Nobody's talking about it at all. Not even, you know, yeah. Every now and then you'll hear somebody, you know, Bad Bunny or something, him mention something. Yeah. But nobody's saying, this is what's going to happen.
Well, that's because
of is that fear in the of creating something?
Well, Mike, that's a good point. I think probably part of that is that the Fed has been more concerned in the recent couple of years with deflation than they are inflation. Because if they were worried about inflation, they wouldn't be printing money like they're printing money. So they're all worried about deflation. And that's one of the reasons rates have stayed stubbornly low, I would say. You know, they should have been higher with all the money they're printing. We should have already seen some inflation, but we're not. Because, well, there's a couple of reasons for it. One is the economy stayed sluggish and the Fed kept, you know, turning the spigot on even wider. Then global central banks started turning on the spigot. So there's just a huge supply of money. History will tell you that's fine for the short run and what they're trying to accomplish in the short run, but I would equate it to pulling that rubber band back on inflation. Just keep pulling it, and at some point, boom, it's going to go. When the economy starts to take off, you're probably going to see some inflation come into the picture pretty quick. Now, the offsetting thing to inflation right now, and the reason we haven't seen inflation, is I think there's two major factors. One is energy related. With all the technology available now and going after resources, you know, they found tremendous amounts of natural gas, which we're going to talk about here in just a second on master limited partnerships. Natural gas and oil reserves right here in the U.S. that we couldn't get to. Now we can get to it. So you're already talking about a situation where that's got the Mideast worried. I think you haven't seen a huge spike in oil prices and gas prices. Because there's a whole new supply out there that could last for another, you know, over a lifespan, more than lifespan, and it's right here. So that's going to help to keep inflation a little bit low. And the other is, as long as unemployment stays stubbornly high, or underemployment, I should say, too, stays high, there's no wage push inflation going on. There's still a lot of people out there looking for jobs. And there's a lot of people who have jobs who would rather get a job that pays what they're supposed to get paid, not just, you know, flip a burger kind of job. So even though you've seen unemployment come down, I think it's 7.7%, part of the reason for that is the denominator has shrunk because people have left the workforce and they don't get included anymore. The better reflection of the workforce and the economy is the underemployment number. So when you have those two factors, that's a little bit less stress on inflation or less pressure on inflation. But when you keep pumping money into the system like they're pumping money into the system, you are going to see inflation. I don't know if it's 12 months down the road, Mike, 24 months down the road, whatever. But I think it's important for us to go ahead and set the framework in this investment policy that allows your bond manager to protect your assets.
I'm just curious as to why. Because, I mean, you've been, for 2 years now, they've been talking about this.
Yep.
Periodically, and you hear little snippets of it, and you probably a year ago at this very meeting was the first time you brought it up, but nobody can seem to say anything. And you know, all of it was keyed, every story, everything that I've heard about it is recovery, recovery, recovery. Now look where we're at. Supposedly we're
well into a recovery, and there's still no.
But it's a job, you know, again, I think the factor that it's a jobless recovery, kind of. At this point in most recoveries, when you go back and look at all those exciting charts, but at this point in most recoveries, after the kind of recession we had in this point in the recovery, the jobless rate is way down, and you know, job growth is way up, and that hasn't happened with this one. It just hasn't.
Okay, that's what I was asking.
Pressure down on rates and keeping a Fed concerned, and the Fed is, you know.
What's the anomaly?
The economy is not healthy enough for the Fed to the extent they can, for them to raise rates. They're not about to raise rates right now, but that doesn't mean they won't 12
months. So you think they're going to keep on pushing that out? Because the last number that was kicked around was 2015 now.
Yeah, they have to push that a little bit, I think, because the economy's not healthy enough. And they don't want to. It's just starting to get some wings, I think, and if you raise rates right now, it would just smash it. You would see. I think it'd be a big problem.
Good.
That doesn't mean, you know, we don't want to. You know, I'm not talking about something that has to be done in the next quarter.
Oh, no.
Yes, it gives. I just concerned that I lived through. I was a bond manager back in 19 in the late 70s. One of the first things I did in my career, late 70s, early 80s, and in the early 80s. Not to show my age, but in the early 80s, it was prime was the big number. They talked about the prime rate. Here, LIBOR now, but it was prime rate back then. And in that period of time, in a 12-month period of time, prime went from 11% to 21% and back down to 11% in a 12-month period of time. A lot of bond people lost a ton of money. I had a lot of government bond funds that are government pension funds, profit sharing funds that were 100% in bonds back then. It was not that unusual. And going out to client meetings showing 7 and 8% negative returns to a 100% government bond fund. And so you can get in those periods. Now, we have actually been in about a 30-year bull market for bonds. A bull market for bonds is defined as interest rates coming down. So interest rates, ever since that time, have really kind of steadily come down. They can't get any lower. So they got to go that way. And I think if we do get into hyperinflation with the kind of money they're printing, that possibility's out there, you've got to take some steps to protect those assets. That's why I'm recommending that. And, you know, and shoot, David might not do anything for another 6 months. I don't know. He may do it right away. It's up to him. That's what you hire Sawgrass to do.
The important thing.
I think the duration is giving him the option of changing the duration of the portfolio.
I'm kind of taking away his excuses, right? I'm kind of taking away Sawgrass's excuses in a way.
Yeah, I mean, it's the only thing that he can truly manage, because the bond quality is going to remain high.
Yeah.
Is that his choices as to duration may make some changes in his relative performance compared to other bond managers. Not that it's going to really kick it up a great deal, because, as you know, Larry.
Yeah.
Well, just as easily be in the top quartile or be in the third quartile and only have a difference of maybe 0.3% or something.
Yeah, that can happen sometimes, that's for sure.
Yeah,
but I mean, even
duration is the one thing that we give them that can keep them sharp in managing the portfolio.
You know, the way the investment policy was originally drafted, it's on page 4, again, you have it in front of you, I guess, Ray, but it was duration of fixed income portfolio shall not be less than 130, or shall be less than 135% of the duration of the index. So we always put a maximum in there, but I intentionally never put a minimum in there, thinking they already would do what I'm asking them to do now.
Right.
But what you'll find, and I'm just, whether it's right or not, we could debate till the end of the day, but Sawgrass isn't alone. Almost every bond manager we talk to will manage to that benchmark and will not go more than internal policy, more than 20% from it. So even though I structured a policy years ago with you all to put the upside risk, I didn't want them having long maturities, because that puts a lot of volatility in your portfolio.
Sure
did. I left the bottom side open so they could go as short as they want, but their internal policies are blocking them from doing that because they managed to the ag. And to find a manager that doesn't do that, it's almost impossible to do. So this gives them that flexibility.
Yeah, I'm all for it.
So I have no problem with that. I just wanted to make sure that then you answered it right off the bat. We're going to be watching to make sure it doesn't, we don't end up losing out because of the too conservative aspect of it, and we start losing returns that way.
Yeah. The only way we'd be a big loser in this is if he takes all 50% that he's allowed here, goes to this short benchmark, and rates just continue to dive. And even then, the definition of loser is we didn't make as much money as the other guy.
Can rates get below zero?
That's what I thought, you know?
They're at zero now. There's some way to
can't see a dive too low. You just can't dive.
Larry, can you talk about this change on page two?
Well, on page two, what I've done is take what's written there on page four and apply it to the total. Because your total benchmark was at 27.5% of Barclays aggregate. So all I've done now is split that bond benchmark up to half of it being the Barclays aggregate and half of it being this shorter term benchmark that I took. That's the only change on page two.
Okay.
That's why I started on four, because that would explain what I did on two. We're just trying to get the bond portfolio flexibility a little bit lower. So he's going to be measured against a target that's got a shorter duration. How he gets there is up to him, and we'll just compare him to his universe and to the benchmarks, and we'll evaluate him every quarter like we always do. And just historically, Sawgrass has done a good job for you. They're a solid bond shop. So this is nothing critical really in them. It's just trying to protect the portfolio going forward.
I move we approve the May 13th Ocala Police Officer's Pension Plan Statement of Investment Policy.
I'll second. Anyone? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passed.
The only other thing relative to that is this. I should pass out. This is a Sawgrass addendum specifically. We're going ahead and changing this.
Wait a minute.
I'm not going to do this shit. Never mind. There's something in there I don't like, so I'm going to revisit that. I'll come back to you next quarter with this.
Some language in there I just saw that I didn't really want in there.
Dale, do you do the filings on the policy?
All right, I'm going to go through the report really quick then, so y'all don't fall asleep on me. But if I hit something, miss something that you want to stop, you know, obviously throw something at me. Look on page three. Do you have a report in front of you, Ray?
No, I don't.
Okay. If I'll try to read off some of the numbers so you can get a feel for everything. On page three on the quarter ending, you can see the market value was $50,187,766. I will tell you, as of today, that's up to about $51,589. So up over $1 million, almost $1.5 million from there, for another about 3% or so from that point. So it's been a strong market since March 31. As of the quarter, you earned $2.96 million, almost $2.7 million. That was 6.4% net of investment management fees just for the quarter, and that's right in line with the target index. Fiscal year to date number, that's your 6 month number. As of March 31, we were up $3.48 million, 7.6%, just slightly below that benchmark, but that's net of investment management fees. Again, a very strong bull market. You're actually keeping up a little bit better in a bull market than I would anticipate normally based on historical. 1 year up 10.1%, $4.5 million basically for the 1 year. Now that fiscal year to date number was 7.6%. Since then, we're up another 2.5 to 3, so probably around 10% as we sit here today on your fiscal year to date. So obviously we can hang on to that. You heard Doug with some of his projections and how what it would do to your 5 year smoothing if certain things happen. If we can keep this kind of year up, your funded ratios and a whole lot of things are gonna look a lot better. Because one of the important things to remember, well, I'll get to it in a minute, but 2008 falls off on your 5 year average this year, at the end of this year, so I'll show you what that number is. The policy review starts on page 4 and 5. I'll talk about each of the managers here in just a second, but if you go to page 5, the last section there, where it starts the equity portfolio, including convertibles, everything from there on down, if it was marked no, we'd have to fix it right away. That's policy language and either our statute, ordinance, or whatever they make an investment policy. We're in compliance, so there's no compliance issues. Page 6 is your asset allocation as of 3/31, a little overweighted to domestic equities.
a little underweighted to international and convertibles and real estate. We've committed money to real estate. Another $150,000 went to real estate after this report. So on April, I believe it was April 1st, if I'm not mistaken. So they're calling for it as they need it. We're sending it to them. But we're underweighted. I'm okay with everything there, especially pending a discussion I would like to have today on master limited partnerships. So we may take some money out of the domestic equities, but that overweight has helped you in this market, obviously, with the stocks doing so well. Your managers are on page 7. You can see how everything's allocated. You just heard from Perimeter. Perimeter manages about 3.3% of your assets, a little over $1.6 million, $1.7 million. And I'll cover them in a second. Page 9. These are your gross of fees returned for different time periods. You can see six go down to the line called total. This is on page 9. My book's laid out a little different. 6.5% versus your benchmark of 6.3, 7.9 fiscal year to date, right in line with the benchmark. 10.8 for 1 year, 8.3 for two, 9.4 for 3 years. That's 9.4% per year for the last 3 years. And then 5.4 for the last 5 years, which still includes 2008 in it. My only point here being, do you remember, was it a year or two ago, we had the state actuary on the line, and their argument was the three-year return.
That was only some of us.
Your three-year return was nowhere near 8.5%, so then you lower it, and I said, well, it's nowhere near 8. Why are you okay with 8? And they got kind of angry at me. Well, the three-year return now is 9.4. And you saw some of Doug's numbers, too, with what happens if you know, with some very reasonable expectations, what happens to your five-year average. And your 30-year average in this plan is well above your actual assumption. Page 10 shows what I was talking about in 2008 dropping off. So you got, in my opinion, and that's what it is, but you got the state putting a lot of pressure on municipalities to lower their interest rates and cost the funding source millions and millions of dollars based on an aberration in the market that occurred in 1 year. So when you start hearing actuaries talk about 3 years and 4 years instead of 25 and 30 years, there's probably an agenda behind it. That's my personal opinion. And in this case, I think they want to lower that assumption rate, make these plans so expensive that cities are forced to shut them down.
And that's exactly what we're fighting, right? We're in the process of right now. Hey, what's happened already. They're next, and we're right behind it. And this is what numbers the people that this city's using are coming with. You know, they've got an actuary and an attorney who are telling them one thing, which is exactly the opposite of a lot of what Doug's saying.
Well, I'm really surprised at some of the people that have jumped on board on this because, I'm just surprised, let's put it that way, because it costs a lot of money to terminate these plans. It's going to cost the taxpayer a fortune down the road. If you put DC plans in place for municipal employees across the state, and then you go 30 years down the road and they have to retire with an average balance of $50,000 and expect to live 30 years off of that, the taxpayer is going to be paying for it. One way or another.
They're all going to be on food stamps.
Yeah, it'll be a disaster. And these plans are not in bad shape. You hear Doug, and I know Doug's firm has been very active in this, and these plans are not broken. And quote, trying to paint them with brushes like California or Illinois or some of these plans that are broken.
The city manager told the city council in a meeting on tape, "Look, I just got the numbers for police and fire, and it's bad, real bad. Something's going to have to be done."
Well, and then I suspect, and I don't know this, but I suspect back in the late 90s and up into early 2000s, probably, I don't know if you didn't have to put any dollars in, but I bet the dollars were pretty minimal.
As late as 2002, they were contributing 6%.
Yeah. And so that seems to be forgotten. And again, here's look at these fiscal year returns on that page. You'll see how it is. And you know, a lot of people, I've told you guys this before, I think, but a lot of people say, well, these market projections, the capital market projections are, we're not going to get anywhere near what we've gotten over the last 30 years. But, you know, capital market projections. Those capital market projections come out every single year. They pay people millions of dollars to do them. They're very smart people, and they're never right. Never right.
I've been doing this for over 30 years. They're never right. So you can look at it. I don't care if it's Merrill Lynch, JP Morgan, I don't care who it is. They put out these market projections. Do you think any of those, if you went back 3 years ago, do you think you would have found anybody with a market projection of the kind of equity returns we've had the last 3 years? If you do, show it to me, because it won't be, you won't see it out. And so I think to make changes to plans that cost cities, like lowering the assumption rate, that cost millions of dollars, or to make changes like terminating a plan that's going to cost taxpayers, I think, billions of dollars down the road, based on capital market assumptions that have never been accurate, doesn't seem prudent to me. And so if I can help you out on that, and council meetings or anything like that, we've done some. I think Doug's firm's done some. I think Doug's done personally, but you know, we've tried to address councils. It's hard to do because sometimes they just already have their mind set up, but be glad to help you out any way I can there. But it's just and a lot of people think, well, we're biased, and even that, well, this is the kind of work you do, so you really want to fight for these defined benefit plans. But the reality is, we also do defined contribution consulting. If every plan we work with had to go to a DC plan, we'd probably double our business. So they're wrong in that assumption. You know, it'd be a growth market for us, not a death wish. Because these pension plans, if you closed it tomorrow, it's still going to be around. You're still going to need me coming in here for a long time. Or some of them, but me or not, and somebody, hopefully me. So I get off my high horse there, but it's starting to get on the nerves of all the stuff that's coming out here lately. Page 11 is your returns relative to a larger national public funds universe. You can see you're in the top 15% for the quarter, top 31% for the year, top 21% for 2 years, average 52% for 3 years, and back up to the top 36% for the 5 years. So good performance overall. Sawgrass large cap growth is on page 12. Done a great job for you. 2 year numbers in the first percentile. They are the exception to the rule. I'll tell you, most large cap growth managers are struggling to beat the benchmark. Less than 10% of them out there, I think, are really beating their benchmark. So this is a phenomenon. And they've had their troubles in the past, but they really came roaring back. So they've done a great job of stock selection in a difficult. They've caught a lot of fish in a pond where they weren't fighting in that large cap growth pond. So hats off to them. Westwood is following the trend of a lot of managers and struggling a little bit to keep up with their benchmarking here. I actually went out and visited them, did a due diligence visit, spent about 4 hours in the firm back in February, met with all their management teams and their analysts and also their compliance people. I also spent a few minutes actually with their chairman and founder, a lady named Susan Byrne. Some of you may know that name if you watch any of the business channels, and all very well respected. Bottom line is the team here is intact. The fundamentals, when fundamentals matter again, these people should come screaming back. They're not blowing it big time. As you can see, the universe rankings are a little below average, but they're not down in the 99th percentile or anything like that. The absolute numbers are pretty good, so just stay a little bit more patient with them, because they've got a good long-term track record, and I think you'll see it come back. Sort of in the same category as Frontier, I mean as Perimeter, a little bit like that. Frontier, okay, for every manager struggling, it's nice to see this one, because you have two managers here with first percentile numbers, one's in 2 year and Frontier's in the one, so they came roaring through this period really well, as you can see.
We finally hired a firm at the
got one that worked. And right out of the box, too. Yeah, we didn't have to put it down.
I got it. Seems like that's the case. This one's really working well. Done a great job. And you saw Perimeter heard from them. Their numbers that I was quoting were on page 18. Page 20 is Advent, your convertibles. A little below the benchmark just because they don't have quite the equity sensitivity. I won't go way down in the weeds again on convertibles, but you can invest in different things there. So they should do well when the market's not quite as strong. But they're hanging in there pretty good. Actually, they're in the top 27% of the convertible managers. They just don't have a lot of equity sensitivity. They're doing a good job. Remember, especially we took bond money to help fund these guys. So this was kind of a bond, chicken way to play the stock market. I won't call it a bond substitute, but it was a way to lower the bond weightings, and relative to bonds, it's done extremely well. Euro Pacific struggled, mostly because of the Euro part of that name. So
little struggle for the quarter and the fiscal year to date, still got good long-term numbers, and that team's intact, so we've spent some time talking to them. They'll be fine. Don't worry about them right now. And then Sawgrass fixed income, no surprises, pretty steady as they go on page 24. Doesn't take a lot of risk, and there's some pretty consistent returns. With that, any questions on the report before I quickly go into another subject? No. Well, last meeting I mentioned to you that one of the asset classes that we've been looking at now for over a year, about a year and a half now, and done a lot of due diligence on it, interviewed a lot of managers, and it is it has the space called Master Limited Partnerships. And primarily, to simplify it, it's really kind of a play on energy and on the pipelines that are required, pipelines and storage required to get the energy from point A to point B, or get the commodity, if you will, from point A to point B. They have a lot of tax advantages, which we don't care about as a tax-exempt plan, but they do have a lot of tax advantages, which is kind of where they got started. But now that market has gotten a lot more liquid, it's gotten much bigger. It kind of relates a little bit to the size of the convertible market. And it's an asset class that, again, with our size, where we're trying to almost use our size as an advantage, we can sold on about $3 billion in assets. We could put every one of our clients up to 5 or 10% in this asset class and not affect it, and not have a liquidity problem. You know, some of the larger players out there would do multi-billion dollars would probably have an issue with that because there's not enough liquidity. But it's an asset class that has very low correlation to both stocks and bonds, which means it helps smooth the ride a little bit. It's got high dividend, high income. These are publicly traded limited partnerships. They have income yield between 5 and 7%, and they will participate, we think, in the growth of domestic energy production. And what I've got here is a little handout information, kind of a MLP 101, which I'll go through maybe really, if is it okay with that? Does it mean time-wise?
I don't know if you guys can go out with this knowledge or not.
Ray, again, I apologize. I could have emailed you something, but I knew you weren't going to be here.
Great, that's okay.
I'll get copies to Dale, or he can get them out to you.
Dale can get them over to me, right?
Yeah. Because this may be a little bit even more boring by phone than it is in person. So go to page 2, and this just explains what Master Limited Partnerships. Right now, the yield is about 5.5%. That's down a little bit because the market values of them have gone up. They've actually been kind of a hot asset class. Now, I'm not chasing them because they're a hot asset class. I think most of you have worked with me long enough to know that's not what we do. But they still are an asset class that we think can add a lot of value in terms of not only return, but reducing volatility in the portfolio. They have to distribute, this is kind of just the structure of 90% of their income. That doesn't really matter to you other than that's what they are, limited partnership. Most of them, these are publicly traded operating in energy toll roads. That's the way I would like you to think of this. The pipelines are like toll roads. I don't care if oil's at $110 or $60, the pipeline, they still got to go through the pipeline. The fact that they've found a lot more domestic resources or fields of both natural gas and oil and can get to it through fracking, it's still got to get from point A to point B. So the toll roads are going to get busier. And that's what we're looking at here is investing primarily in those pipelines. Good cash flow, and you can see that I've got some risk stuff I'll talk about here. What are the risks of it? There's different types of MLPs, just on page 3, what we're focusing on and what the area we like is this midstream toll, which is the toll road. We don't really want to go in by it. We're not buying the oil rigs or the drills or drillers or anything like that, but we're not buying the gasoline, we're not buying the gas stations or the refineries. We're talking about pipelines and storage, kind of what they call the midstream. Here are the returns. Now, this would almost scare you away, I think, but show them to you anyway. The returns, as you can see, for the asset class versus other asset classes, and it happens to be the one on the far right. That's the Alerian Index. They've done extremely well over the last 5 and 10 years. That's 5 years on the top, 10 years on the bottom. So the question comes up, or at least it doesn't see in a lot of people when they look at a chart like this, or are we too late to this game? Are we jumping in too late? And the answer is no, because I don't think so. And we've asked the managers that specialize in this too. Of course, they might be a little biased, but you know, we've tried to get a feel because of the new discoveries and the demand to get this oil and gas to different points. There's going to be tremendous growth in this area to continue. Now, the correlation, which is one of the reasons we like it, and this is a chart that can be confusing, but the lower the number here on page 5, the more attractive it is as a diversifier, as something that would add to the portfolio and reduce risk. And so you can see the Alerian MLP index is that column 1. Go right down that column and you'll see all those numbers. Like, for instance, go down to the Barclays Intermediate Aggregate 0.01. So there's really no correlation between the performance of this and that asset class. Go down to stocks, Russell 1000 growth, it's even in the 60s. So they are stocks, but yet they don't correlate 100% with stocks. That's what this points out. So when you have a low correlation to the other asset classes that you're already invested in, if you can still get the return and have a low correlation, it'll smooth the ride over the long term in terms of volatility. Does that make sense to everybody? The risk reward for the different asset classes, let's talk about a busy page. On page 6, that's all the different asset classes. You've had some exposure to some of them, not all of them, but some. And then the Alerian index is the red triangle right in the middle of the page. The Russell 1000 value, just to show you how it compares. These are considered high yielding stocks, which would fall kind of in the value universe. That's why that's circled. So they would kind of fall into that. We're going to treat them as a separate asset class, but they're kind of that way. So you can see that they performed substantially better than straight value stocks. Page 7 shows each year going back to 2002 and what the best performing, this is just bond stocks and the MLPs, and it shows where they performed. And the point of this is just showing you that there's only one period there where they're at the bottom, and that was 2008. Every other time they're either, as a matter of fact, they spend a lot of time as the best performing asset class. But they can be volatile. They are a stock. So not trying to paint all rosy picture. Their performance then over the last 10 years on page 8 relative to stocks and bonds.
Is that number right here, Trust? 85% 2009?
Yeah. Came roaring back after they lost 38.5%. That's one of the reasons why we put that chart in here, though, was to show you that even with that, you know, there are other periods where, a lot of other periods where it's also the best performing asset class. So what their long-term numbers can get kind of skewered by a year like that, obviously. But you can see there's been some pretty consistent returns here every year from the asset class. The growth drivers are listed on page 9. I've tried to kind of talk about those, and so you can see some of the new finds there on the bottom left. Page 10 explains the index just a little bit. We're not recommending that you necessarily go with an index product. There are several different ways you can invest in the asset class, and those are invest in the asset class, which are listed on page 11. You're large enough that we're going to recommend you either go with a separately managed portfolio of actively managed, or interestingly enough, Westwood has a product now that is a commingled fund just for pension funds that is doing this. They've done it. They've managed the MLPs for a long time. They have over a 10-year track record and done a very good job, but they started a commingled fund here just within the last couple of quarters for investors such as you. So, but we have some other managers. If we just flip through, I don't know if I'm going too fast on this or not, but go to page 17. And there's a couple of, we're doing our due diligence. We've got three managers that we like in the space right now that we would, comfortable recommending: Miller Howard, Tortoise, and Westwood. And you can see the firm assets plus the product assets, Westwood being the smallest in this space, but as you know, a $14 billion firm. Tortoise, good manager, $3.5 billion in this space. they have $10.5 billion in the MLP space. This particular midstream product is $3.5 billion, and then $972 million with Miller Howard. And then you see vehicle over on the right. It's separately managed, and then commingled. Here's one of the advantages to the only question mark, and Lee's probably heard this before, but there's some question. There is something called UBTI, unrelated business taxable income, that these can generate. And there's question as to whether or not, even as a pension fund, you have to pay UBTI. It appears the answer is no, but nobody has got a clear definition of that or a clear answer to that. I don't know. I haven't had a meeting with Lee on this, but I was with Scott just last week, and he agreed. There's no clear answer as to whether it is or not. If you have the managers in, they'll tell you that the good news is, if there is any UBTI, they will tell you they've never had UBTI. They've never had the jet. And Tortoise has been doing it a long time. Miller has been doing it. They never generated, had to pay UBTI. And that's because they can aggregate it. If one of the MLPs, one of the companies they're investing in, creates some UBTI, if another one has UBTI losses, they can offset and treat it in the aggregate, and they don't have to file. So there's no, they would say, we haven't had any. That doesn't mean there couldn't be some. If there is, it could cause an issue as to whether or not, if you're in a separately managed portfolio, as to whether or not we had to file a UBTI. Likelihood of it appears to be pretty low. But if it's there, it comes up, you have to go to your accountant, auditor, whatever, and say, hey, you got this, do what you got to do with it. It would probably be a very small amount, even if there was any, especially relative to your total portfolio, but it is something you need to think about. One of the reasons that Westwood started that commingled fund was to address that issue. If it ever comes up, it still wouldn't impact you directly. It would impact you indirectly because they would pay it at the fund level. They would do all the filing and pay at the fund level. You would never have to do it. You just get a, you know, slightly lower return, whatever that filing was. So that's one thing. But before I get that far into the pros and cons of each manager, because they're all very good at this, and all their numbers are on pages 18, 19, and 20. You can see how they shake out risk reward versus the index. Again, they're all good at what they do. The question I guess I would have is, if you like what you hear or are more interested in the asset class, I would suggest that you have a couple of these managers in and let them, you know, give you a 15-20 minute presentation, let you ask questions, more detailed questions if you have any, and proceed from there before you invested any money with them. But I'm open to anyone, that's anybody you like.
I have a question. Are you at all concerned about Perimeter and how they're really even lagging behind?
Perimeter?
Yeah.
Well, as I said, Ray, on Perimeter, they've had nothing but a bull market since they've been with you. And they are struggling. But the trend, the last three quarters, they've actually outperformed as that correlation number's gone down. So, you know, when somebody's underperforming like that, the first thing we try to do is go in. What we don't want to get in the habit of doing is hiring at the top, firing at the bottom.
Right.
And what we try to do is go in, can we get our hands around something that gives us confidence that there's something going on in the market or whatever that's more of an aberration than a long-term issue here. And in their case, it was pretty easy to do that. When correlations are high, they don't do as well. They don't, when markets are up strong and correlations are high, they don't keep up very well. But they have shown in the past, over their 15-year track record. And these are guys, you know, used to be at, I don't know if you knew them when you were with SunBank, but they were Trustco part. They broke out from Trustco.
Okay, no, I didn't
know. Whole team. So we know their long-term track record pretty well.
Yeah.
And they their history anyway is in a down market, any kind of sustained down market, they should make it up and then some. Or when fundamentals matter again, when correlations go down, and that's exactly what we've seen. So as long as we see that pattern, they haven't been through a full cycle of up market and down market yet to give them maybe a long-term fair evaluation. They've had trouble keeping up on the upside. That doesn't totally surprise us. If they don't make it up on the downside, then I think it's an issue. But right now we're seeing improvement, even though we're not even in a down market, just because correlations have come down.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Larry, how much money are you talking about investing, and where do you propose to move from?
Well, initially, I would say about, probably start off with about 5%. We'd like for 5 to 10% as the range in the investment policy. Start off with 5%, which will be about $2.5 million. In that ballpark, about $2.5 million into the asset class.
Okay. All for fixed?
No, that would all come from equity right now, just because we're overweight in equity and we're pretty low on bonds. So it's kind of an equity diversifier right now, but they are equities, there's no doubt about it.
Okay.
They're high yielding equities, but they're equities. But as I showed on page 6, we're pretty overweighted in domestic stocks. We'll pull some there and actually treat this as an alternative asset class, separate asset class. But for purposes of the state statutes and investment policy, equity limits will treat it as stocks. So then we'll go over 75%, I believe it is. But again, before you invest in my recommendation, and you can do it any way you like, but I would have them in and talk to them and learn a little bit more about it if it's all fine.
Well, I like the idea of high yield.
Their numbers, I mean, even looking at any of them, the lowest one was 19.5 last year, you know, 24.
Yeah, the performance numbers are almost scary good, you know, and I recognize that. We as a firm have recognized that, tried to go in there and dissect it. I mean, the risks associated with this asset class are, I would say the two major risks would be a higher interest rate environment. The yield wouldn't be as attractive, but rates have got to go up pretty significantly. But they can grow their distributions in these MLPs too, so that may not be a risk, but it could be. In other words, in an interest rate environment where, like Randy was saying earlier, where we're at zero, 5.5% looks pretty good. But the other risk associated with the asset class would be legislative tax changes, where if these things didn't become as attractive to taxable investors, you could have an impact. We saw a little bit of that increase in volatility in the fourth quarter of last year when there was talk that they might change some tax regulations relative to these, never even got voted on. So it was not an issue, then it came reporting back in the first quarter. So.
With looking at the fees, I'm not saying one over the other, but Westwood has the highest fees, but they...
Well, I'll tell you, Westwood would work with
that. Lower us, because they have almost $11 million already.
I think you can safely say, no, we have, yeah, because you already have money invested with them, they just did this last week, so I have no reason, I didn't ask them, but I have no reason to believe they'd probably go down to 75 basis points on that commingled fund. I think that matches what Miller Housing.
Yeah.
Tortoise stays at one, I think they're at one. I don't think they're not going to be too flexible with their size or so big. But they're good. I mean, all three really good. Like I said, we talked to several managers who specialize in this space. And these are the three that we there's a couple more are right on the edge of being recommended, but this is where we are right now.
I got nothing to
top on them. Sensitive to bring managers in, taking your time, but I do think diversification is important. And this is an asset class that certainly looks kind of appealing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we need to take a look at it.
Yeah. Oh, I got a problem.
Well, you want to bring all three in, or you want to narrow it down to a couple here today? Which would you rather do?
Have no clue.
The numbers are all pretty similar.
Yeah, they are. And they're all okay for $2.5 million a separate portfolio?
They are right now. It'd be interesting to see.
Well, Westwood's a commingled.
Westwood's commingled.
What's the downside of that?
I really haven't found one yet. I kind of like it because of that potential tax situation. It is daily value, so there's no liquidity issues with it yet. The downside is it's relatively new, the fund itself, but their track record and the management team is not. And so they're managing exactly, it looks exactly like a separately managed portfolio, so there's no difference there. So I think it was a pretty smart move on their part, quite frankly, but, and this is starting to get some, I think we're not to break my arm patting ourselves on the back, but I think we're a little early to this game, and because we've already done a lot of our due diligence, but I'm getting wind that some other consultants and other are starting to either look at the asset class or recommend it, and so we're kind of in the early innings, I think, of this product being out there getting popular, so.
I mean, if we're wanting to cut somebody, all their numbers are pretty similar, and Torres is going to charge us 25% more. But I have no problem listening to all three of them.
Yeah, I mean, neither do I, but I agree with what Matt's saying. If we're looking at cost wise, and you think Westwood's going to do, you've got two managers who are going to do the same thing, and one that you're saying is not flexible.
I mean, I don't
matter to me.
Nobody's numbers are 25% better than the other ones.
Why don't I just bring Miller Howard and Westwood in next meeting?
Okay.
Sound good? And while we're bringing Westwood in, you want to just go ahead and do the large cap value review, 10 minutes maybe?
Yeah.
I'll tell Kim Calhoun to do a 10-minute review there. She'll probably bring the portfolio manager for the MLPs with her. Be my guess about that. Okay. All right, that's all. I think I've done enough damage.
Any questions? Ray, you got anything?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I have a final copy of that policy for you, Mr. Venture Matson. Okay with that language?
All right, go on. The next item on the agenda is the addendum to operating rules regarding confidentiality of officer records.
Okay, this is an addendum we did to our operating rules, adding to the confidentiality section the additional confidentiality provision we talked about it last year, which is birth dates, and it's simply adding that to our rule on that. So I recommend it up by motion and just add it to our operating rules and procedures.
Sounds good.
I'll move that we accept and approve the addendum for extending confidentiality records.
And I second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
In that regard, Dale, did we receive a request from the division for the confident? Okay, has that been done yet?
Yes, it has.
Okay. What I was referring to there is with respect to confidential information under the statute for years, with respect to the city, if somebody came to the city and asked for that confidential information, the city could deny it and not be in violation of public records. For a third party that has that information, which includes the Division of Retirement, a request has to be made of that third party to not disclose that information, and that's why you received this. The only thing that puzzles me is why we didn't get it 15 or 20 years ago. But it's been signed and sent in, so now if somebody goes to the Division and asks for that information, they can deny it without violating public records. I'm in the process of drafting the required Internal Revenue Code amendments to our plan. It will not change any of our substantive provisions, but the language does need to be in for compliance purposes. Also, on the legislative front, you're probably aware by now that Senate Bill 458, which attempted to mandate what we couldn't do with our state money, fortunately that did not pass the House, so we got out from under that for another year. Unfortunately, one bill that did pass the House and the Senate, and if the governor doesn't veto it, we will have to comply with this as well as every other defined benefit plan in the state, and that's Senate Bill 534, which you may recall imposes additional filing and disclosure requirements on the fund. It will result in additional administrative expenses, primarily for additional actuarial fees that will incur because of calculations that are required. That's one thing bad about it. The other thing that's bad about it is the proponents of that bill are attempting to gather information that they can argue against the continued existence of the defined benefit plans over the next several years. So, not a good bill. I haven't run into many people who like it, including cities. Cities think it's an infringement on home rule. I agree. It does add administrative expense, but nonetheless, did pass the Senate and the House, and unless the governor vetoes it, it will become law. And I think when it does, when and if it becomes law, I'm sure Doug will send out correspondence indicating what effect that will have on what they're going for us and how much it will cost.
Ballpark guess, how much?
It's going to be a little pricey. It's there's no ballpark yet, but we've got new GASB requirements that are first coming online. That's separate from the state stuff. And then we're going to have to essentially run between 4 and 5 separate valuations on the new GASB basis, every valuation. And not for funding, it's just, it's accounting, basically. It's accountants want to see this information, but it's going from one valuation per year, we're going to go to probably 5 or 6 valuations a year.
Wow.
We're not going to charge 5 times the current, but
I would appreciate it.
I'm thinking it's probably going to be, the valuation fee is probably going to go up 25 to 50% for most of our clients. There's just no way around it.
Another unfunded state mandate.
Mm-hmm. What's the likelihood of them vetoing it? Is there already...
Governor, I don't think it's great. Was that a commentary, right?
Yeah.
So
he's in the line.
And the last item for today is just our annual reminder to file your financial disclosures Form 1 by July 1st with proof of filing. Almost filed.
I can already file mine.
They've been out, the forms have been available for several months now, right?
Yeah, okay. I'll be checking. I checked it with the supervisor of elections, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And as I found out, if you don't do it on time, then you get all kinds of nasty emails and more letters and
ultimately a fine.
Well, I got it done before the fine.
Aren't there some extra teeth in there, some new legislation about that disclosure? Something
is an accuracy, you mean?
Pretty timing or something. Something crazy.
And also now they have filed civil suits against all those that have had unpaid fines. And so too, there's a trustee on the East Coast who was in a dispute with the commissioner, and the commissioner looked up the prior filing and saw there was something not accurate, and ended up costing the trustee over $38,000. And fines and attorney's fees.
Yeah, like $25 a day is the initial.
Yeah, the fine. The statutory process for the fine is that you file by July 1. If not, you get a notice from the supervisor saying you have a grace period to file to September 1st. Mm-hmm. If you then don't file by September 1st, the fine starts to run on September 1st, $25 a day. And then when it hits $1,500, you get a bill for
$1,500. Now, Lee, I can just call the supervisor and find out if my report is current, right?
I believe you can, right.
Yeah, I think I filed it when it first came to me. And
usually they have it on time.
Quite a few months ago, right?
We have to do it.
It would have had to have been this calendar year, right?
Okay, I'll check into that.
And be sure the one that you file up in the upper right-hand corner is for 2012.
For 2012, right, okay.
Mm-hmm. And anybody that's going to Tallahassee next week, I'll see you there. You're going, aren't you, Mike?
I am.
It's Trisha's swan song.
Oh, that's right, she's from Turner.
Yeah.
Have they named her replacement?
That's
the scary part.
Yeah, I...
No, it's not the actuary, is it?
I don't know.
Just right slap
it on my knees. You know, Senator Sledge retired at the end of last calendar year, and her replacement was somebody who used to be with the Ohio retirement system, and haven't had contact with him. I don't know how he is one way or another, but, you know, ever since late 70s, Marvin Clayton and Trish, his assistant, they've always been very friendly to pension and employees. I'm afraid, given the fact that Scott appoints these folks, I'm not so sure we're going to have as friendly an environment up there as what we've had.
Yeah.
all these years.
Is that it?
I got one thing. It's that time of year again for an election, so we'll have to.
Who's up for it?
Mike is up.
I was just originally reeling.
Are we electing chairman and vice chairman?
Yeah, that won't be till August, until we.
I'll be sure that ten will be.
Don't show anybody in the back.
Yeah, I think Dane's position comes up this year. And it took us 4 months, 5 months to get Ray's approved last year.
Good luck.
All right.
Yeah, we might want to go ahead and start that process.
Yeah, hopefully we can get the city to, you know, post it and be happy with the fact that nobody else put in for it, you know?
So they don't post it.
So they don't post it 18 times.
Nine times. That's all I have.
I just know it's gotta be posted. Then I can.
But it doesn't have to be posted 9 times.
Does anybody have anything else?
Cool.
It's important and needs to be talked about. One twice.
We're done.
Meeting is adjourned. It is 2:57.
Okay, thank you all very much. Thank you, Ray. We appreciate it.
Stuff in only 2 hours.